You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a Wisconsin veterans home is under review over concerns about the quality of care. We'll hear from the reporters who broke that story. Now it's muskie season across Wisconsin. Last weekend was opening weekend for the state's northern region. The season's been open in southern Wisconsin since early last month. The official state fish has a reputation for being hard to catch, but our next guest says the odds for anglers may actually be getting better. Zach Lawson is a fisheries biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Zach, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So some people might be intimidated by their chances of catching a muskie. What's your case for going out now that the season is upon us around the state?
Well, right now is a pretty good time to get out and start hunting for muskies. We've got most populations throughout the Northwoods have kind of wrapped up their spawn, and a lot of those fish have recovered from spawning and now are in their post-spawn feeding pattern, if you will, and that makes a lot of those fish in very shallow areas and a lot more accessible to anglers. So it's a good time of year to get out there and try to hook up with a muskie.
Now, the muskie fisher folk out there know all about them, but for everybody else, can you give us a little muskie 101? Describe them, tell us about them, and why people love to fish for them.
Well, muskie, they have quite an allure about them. They're fabled as kind of the fish of 10,000 casts, and they're this big, predatory, toothy, mean critter that's in very low densities in a lot of our lakes and rivers in Wisconsin, and so just not being able to run into them very often historically, they kind of just have this mystique about them, and so to even see a muskie, is quite a thing. But nowadays, as angling has become a little bit better for them in terms of catch rates and the amount of quote unquote action anglers might see, it's just a ton of fun is the only way to really to put it. So once you hook up with a muskie, you'll never forget it. And you'll just want to keep doing it more and more and more.
Now, I saw a picture of you a few years back with a muskie that looked like you could get a pretty good workout bench pressing that guy.
Oh, that's right. Yep. Obviously, muskie anglers try to very frequently go after the largest individuals that they can find. And so it can be a real tussle when you tangle with one.
What do we know about how the muskie population is doing statewide?
Well, as I just mentioned, muskie fishing previously used to be sort of thing where you might go weeks or months without even seeing a fish. And these fish naturally occur in really low densities in our systems. But in the course of, maybe the late 70s and in 1980s and 1990s, a lot of muskie anglers started adopting this catch and release ethic. And through that effort and through learning a lot through management agency and as research continued to build, we learned a lot more about how to better manage these species and fisheries. And through, the course of time, nowadays we find ourselves in really the good old days of muskie fishing. And so, starting in maybe the 2000s to present day, we've noticed in a lot of our survey work that, muskies are more prevalent on the landscape than they used to be. And angler catch rates have really, increased. So it takes a lot less time for anglers to go out and successfully catch a muskie. And so our fisheries, for the most part in northern Wisconsin are in fantastic shape and some of the best, providing some of the best fisheries that they ever have. So things look good for anglers out there.
And briefly, what do first timers need to know about the rules as far as when, how, and what to catch, when to catch and release?
Well, anglers should definitely be aware of the size limits, size and bag limits. So kind of the blanketed regulation is a 40-inch minimum length limit and a one fish daily bag limit. But there are muskies being a trophy species. There are a lot of special regulations out there. You'll see in some areas, for example, a 50-inch minimum on some lakes. And then you'll see in a lot of our action waters, quote unquote action waters, where they're at higher densities, you'll see, for example, a 28-inch minimum. So you need to be aware of the specific water body that you're on and what the harvest the size limit is for that respective water body. And other than that, you know, need to be aware of when the season is open. Obviously, you just mentioned that muskie season just opened last weekend, and we'll go in northern Wisconsin until the end of the calendar year, so the end of December, all through open water only. So good to pick up a regulations packet and comb through things for where you're going to be fishing to know exactly. But those are the major regulations to kind of sidebar with.
And in just our last half a minute or so, Zach, I understand Wisconsin maybe set some world records when it comes to muskies.
That is true. That is very true. Yep. Well, back in the day, currently the current world record is definitely, you know, came from Wisconsin. And, you know, the next world record might be swimming out there. We've got a lot of systems like Green Bay that are pumping out a lot of big fish. And so no doubt there could be the next world record swimming around right now.
Zach, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That was Zach Lawson. He's a fisheries biologist for Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. He was with us today to talk about the beginning of muskie season in Wisconsin and how the muskie population is doing across the state. If you happen to catch that world record muskie, let us know about it. We'll talk to you. Email ideas@WPR.org. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story of a food tradition from a Caribbean island.
Cooking can transport us to another place, another time. When we cook, we're able to keep our family's dishes and memories alive for generation after generation. That's the case for Anne Marie Herman in Madison, who was raised on the island of St. Lucia. WPR's El Malik Anderson brings us her story about fish cakes. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
The smell of hot oil, jerk chicken, and freshly baked bread with coconut and chocolate chips fill Anne Marie Herman's kitchen in Madison. She heats up the oil in a large, heavy cast iron pan over her stovetop. Her ingredients wait on the countertop, ready to be put to work.
This is flour. This is the codfish. It has thyme, onion, garlic, and other spices.
On the menu today, salted fish cakes. She fills the frying pan with as many battered fish cakes as she can at once. After they are all done, she takes them out of the pan and places them on top of a huge pile of more fish cakes. This dish has been a part of Herman's life for a long time.
I was born in the Caribbean islands, St. Lucia. But when I was much younger, I used to cook for my older brothers. That's how I started cooking, real cooking.
Herman grew up in the countryside with her mother and would go back and forth to the middle of the town to cook for her elder brothers who were taxi drivers.
My brothers were taxi drivers who were in the middle of town driving tourists and stuff, so they don't have time to do anything with cooking. So I used to do the cooking for them. But what my trick was not using a lot of fat in my food. I didn't use to measure a lot of stuff when I was cooking.
Herman started keeping track of her measurements for each dish when she decided to publish a cookbook of family favorite recipes with a Caribbean twist.
You see inside of it? It has all the Caribbean islands in there. That's my idea of putting the Caribbean foods together.
In her cookbook, she shares recipes for beef patties, fried green plantains, aloha friendship bread. There's also jerk chicken and other dishes her family enjoys.
Fish cakes is another thing I make often. You take codfish, you boil it because it has a lot of sodium in it. So you wash it first, then you put it in a little pot to boil. And then when you give it a few minutes to cook, when it softens, you wash it again. You put more cold water on it to take the salt. Then you shred it and you add spices to it.
She said her fish cakes are always a hit among her friends in the Caribbean Association of Madison.
Sometimes I even try to hide it, but they find it before the meal. And some people will come and say, where is the fritters? They call it fritters. They ask me, where are the fritters you brought? It's there, but when you look, it's gone.
Saint Lucia, Helen of the West.
WPR producer L. Malik Anderson brought us that story on Anne-Marie Herman's Fish Cakes. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, an investigation led by reporters at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel found that the Wisconsin State Veterans Home in Union Grove is among the worst in the nation when it comes to care violations. The reporters join us to share their findings. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, reporters at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel investigated a veterans home in Racine County and found it has among the most violations and federal fines of all the Medicare and Medicaid-certified vets homes in the country. Veterans homes can be more affordable than regular care facilities and are intended to be a place where veterans can connect with each other about their experiences. But according to this Journal-Sentinel investigation, the state veterans home at Union Grove is among the most troubled nursing homes in the state, ranking the top 10% for the most violations, with three times more violations than the average home. Daphne Chen is a data and investigations reporter for the Journal-Sentinel, and John Diedrich is an investigative reporter there. I talked to them earlier today about their reporting. First of all, John, what led the two of you to investigate Union Grove?
So we got some calls from family members who were concerned about the care of their loved ones, specifically Luann Krall, whose husband, Randy, died after a number of years of problems there, and her story is detailed in there. We also heard concern from a number of volunteers who were seeing substandard care, and so all those things led us to this investigation.
And Daphne, you looked into reported violations and fines at these kinds of facilities around the country. How did Union Grove in particular stack up?
Yeah, so we sliced the data a couple different ways. And whether you look at the raw number of violations, whether you look at how many they had per inspection, or whether you even look at how many citations they had compared to the average in the state, this facility was always in the top 10, sometimes even higher, top two, top three. So we felt that, you know, it was worth writing about.
And Daphne, what kinds of violations and fines were most common among those?
They had violations for all sorts of things. A lot of it was medication mistakes, things like dehydration, even complaints of abuse allegations, which always get investigated.
John, you talked to many of the veterans there and their families. You mentioned Randy Krall's story. Can you share his story and what he experienced at Union Grove?
Yeah, so Randy was a Navy veteran, had diminished health in recent years, and they thought Union Grove would be a great place to go because they lived in the area. His wife, Luann, shares how there were problems really from the beginning. He had been there almost 4 years. There were problems in there with medication mistakes, with unexplained scratches, bumps, bruises, falling, things of this nature. In the end, the biggest thing that came up, and this preceded Randy's death, was a case of dehydration. Daphne talked about that. This is the experts or the doctors in this case that were looking at his case. They estimated that he was at least 24 hours without liquids, he was rushed to the hospital, and they were not even able to get a urine sample from him at the emergency room. He ended up returning to Union Grove and he passed away not too long after that. There was a investigation into this, a complaint and an investigation, they were fined for the dehydration issue, which had come up with other veterans as well, that they described how it's difficult just to get water there.
Daphne, a lot of operations, businesses, institutions of various kinds saw problems starting with the pandemic. As I understand your reporting, this started even before then. What did you see when it came to trends over time of complaints about violations at Union Grove?
Yeah, so our data goes back further than the pandemic. It starts in 2015. And for whatever reason, a lot of people said that they saw the slide in care beginning around this time. A lot of nursing homes like struggled with staffing. They struggled with infection control during the pandemic, but this predated that time period.
John, what do we know about what's going on, why this is happening?
Well, there's been a real issue of short staffing. As Daphne mentioned, it's a problem throughout the country in this industry. But there is something different with Union Grove in the leadership. That's been a big red flag. So 5 leaders in 5 years, lots of turnover at that high level. And that's one of the things that the state has not been able to get a handle on. The Evers administration, they're the ones who oversee this. They're funded by federal dollars, but state veterans homes are overseen by the states. And this has been a struggle for the state to find a stable leadership there. And from what we hear, that really has hampered care, employee morale, a lot of issues with forced overtime. There has to be coverage, so with short staffing. But it goes beyond that with leadership turning over so often.
We're talking to John Diedrich and Daphne Chen from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the Union Grove Veterans Home, complaints about quality of care there, and possible solutions. Daphne, as we compare the kinds of violations you mentioned at Union Grove with others around the country, Union Grove stands out when it comes to numbers, as you were saying earlier. Does it seem like the more egregious problems, more serious problems, are more common at Union Grove compared to, again, the norm for these facilities?
I might have to punt this one to John. John?
So in terms of the violations, we did see the most serious violation, the immediate jeopardy violation that was hit with Union Grove. And that was in the middle of the pandemic with failure to control the spread of COVID-19. Also abuse violations. There are also less serious violations. And as we look at other homes, specifically in Wisconsin, we see some of those serious violations as well, but the number, the sheer number, and when we look at the, in terms of the serious, the federal government numbers this as far as seriousness, that Union Grove has more of those serious violations. To be sure, they have some less serious violations as well. But the ones that are really concerning to the regulators are, as Daphne mentioned, the abuse and this infection control issue that they had during the pandemic.
Now, John, you talked to various state officials, both in the Veterans Department, in the state legislature, and elsewhere. What kind of things are you hearing from them?
Well, from the State Department of Veterans Affairs, they oversee series of 3 homes in Wisconsin. They laid out a whole series of efforts that they've been engaged in to try to hire and retain staff, to include a bump in pay, not a big one, but a bump in pay, some other steps to try to advertise and recruit. I mean, it's very similar to what other nursing homes are doing. They're trying to step that up at this point because it just seems as if they're in a situation where people are overworked and they're leaving and they just can't get people to come. And as they're short staffed, they just can't get people to fill in. As far as state lawmakers, Robin Voss and Senator, he's the assembly speaker, and Senator Van Wingard, they both represent this district. They're concerned. They've been talking to volunteers and family members as our reporting went on, and they expressed a lot of frustration that the situation hasn't changed. And, you know, what we're waiting for now is to hear from the governor and from others in leadership to be able to say, well, what can be done? And, you know, again, this is one of those situations where the federal government has the money that's going into it, but they don't oversee it, and the state oversees it. So it's a little bit of a tricky situation as far as oversight. And I think that's where there is a push across federal and state government to improve accountability and ultimately the care for these veterans.
And Daphne, as we move ahead, what are you watching for next on the story, or what kind of data are you hoping to find that might not be as readily available?
Yeah, we have lots of follow-ups planned. I mean, one thing that is interesting is that a lot of the data is actually still in the middle of being updated. So there are a couple more citations that are not in the federal data yet that we know have been issued against Union Grove. There are follow-ups regarding, you know, food was a huge issue that people mentioned. I think every person that John interviewed had mentioned the quality of the food there. We're getting lots of tips about other nursing homes as well. So those will be some of the follow-ups.
We'll leave it there for now. Daphne, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Daphne Chen and John Diedrich are with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They talked to us about their reporting on violations reported at the Wisconsin Veterans Home in Union Grove. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, supply chains are still out of whack, leading to alternating shortages and then sometimes oversupplies of some products. We'll sort out the supply chain, the long-term impact these problems could have, and what our guest calls the bullwhip effect. And a science fiction TV show that just had a 3-year run created a franchise that changed pop culture. Boldly explore the many lives of Star Trek with the author of the new book, Phasers on Stun. You can get us started right now. Are you now or have you ever been a Star Trek fan, original series, Next Generation, or some of the new crop of shows coming out to this very day? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll check out a bonus installment of the WPR podcast Mapped Out and find out why a heavily gerrymandered election map may have gotten even more lopsided for the next 10 years. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says there are alarming trends about the future of elected government in the United States. We'll look at the threats and possible solutions. First, the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out, dug into the political redistricting process in Wisconsin when it aired last fall. We looked back at how Republicans redrew district lines to their advantage after winning control of state government in 2010. And the controversy that followed as courts considered whether the state's maps were unconstitutional. We also heard about the first steps in drawing new maps after census data was released last year. A lot has happened since then. Decisions from the state and U.S. Supreme Courts have given Wisconsin one set of maps, then another, with an election just months away. Today we're getting caught up with a bonus episode of Mapped Out with WPR's Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson.
Hey, if you're wondering why this popped up in your podcast feed today, let us remind you why we're here.
This is a podcast about redistricting in Wisconsin. It's a process that political parties anticipate every decade. And once it starts, it sometimes feels like it's never going to end.
We started this podcast last September, right before the state legislature introduced its new maps.
And it's been almost 6 months since our last update. 6 months. And a lot of non-redistricting news has happened since then, so maybe we should start with a refresher.
In November, Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature passed their new maps.
A week later, Democratic Governor Tony Evers vetoed them, sending the fight to the state Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court said it would choose a map based on a measure it called least changes. That is, it wanted to make the least changes to the map Republicans drew in 2011.
And that is where we left things. It was kind of tempting to say, game over, Republicans win. All they had to do was submit a least changes map to a conservative Supreme Court. Easy, right?
Other groups submitted their versions of least changes maps. There were maps from Democratic voters, from community groups, from mathematicians. Even the governor submitted a brand new set of maps.
But you know who didn't submit a new map? The legislature. They stuck with the one they passed in the fall, the one that got vetoed.
And it kind of begged the question, why would they do that? Why push ahead with the map that was already rejected by the governor? Why ignore instructions from the state's highest court?
Well, it doesn't matter, because in the end, the strategy would pay off.
From WPR Reports, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. This is Mapped Out.
So like we were saying, the Wisconsin Supreme Court considered maps from a lot of different people. In January, they each had a chance to make their case before the justices.
Good morning on this nice, crisp Wisconsin morning. The case we have on for hearing today is Johnson versus Wisconsin Election Commission et al.
The court met for hours that day, and while they covered a lot of ground, the topic of least changes came up repeatedly. Lawyer after lawyer told justices their map was the most least. They included Anthony Russomano, a State Department of Justice lawyer representing Democratic Governor Tony Evers.
Your Honors, it's undisputed in this litigation that the governor's maps make the least changes to the existing, no matter how you slice it.
Now, we should say here, Russomano is not talking about the map Evers endorsed as part of his People's Maps Commission. That map failed in the legislature, and Evers pretty much abandoned it.
And in its place, drew a new map, one that was clearly designed to meet the court's least change mandate. By the numbers, it moved the fewest people from one district to another. In redistricting speak, its core retention score was the best.
Now, remember, the Republican legislature decided not to submit a new map, one that was drawn specifically with least change in mind. Why not?
The legislature's attorney, Taylor Meehan, got a chance to answer that question in an exchange with Justice Rebecca Dallet. Meehan said, there's different ways of defining least change.
The legislature's plan optimizes population equality, it optimizes municipal splits, and it optimizes least changes.
Right. If it doesn't optimize least change, you have to admit you're not the least change.
No, Your Honor, we fundamentally disagree with that. A least changes measure.
So to sum up, the legislature says it's still a least change map because the population of its districts is closer to equal and it splits fewer municipalities. They say it's okay that they're not the best when it comes to moving people around, to core retention.
But there were signs that the key justice in this case, conservative swing justice Brian Hagedorn, wasn't buying that argument.
So I'm having a hard time understanding why we would now use that standard when that isn't what we told the parties. If we told the parties we wanted you to submit maps that have perfect equality population like the congressional districts, we should have said so, but we didn't say so. We said something quite different, and I don't want to be Charlie Brown and Lucy here.
Charlie Brown and Lucy, you know, the characters from the old Peanuts cartoon.
You just want me to come running up to kick that ball so you can pull it away and see me land flat on my back and kill myself.
This time you can trust me. See, here's a signed document testifying that I promise not to pull it away.
He gets a running start, and then...
Lucy pulls it away. Charlie Brown goes flying. The rules were changed at the last minute.
Peculiar thing about this document, it was never notarized.
Other conservative justices have no problems with the legislature's argument. They don't see it as Charlie Brown and Lucy. Hagedorn is the tiebreaker. He's the only justice who's unpredictable. If you can persuade him, you have a good chance of winning your case. And about a month and a half after this hearing, Justice Brian Hagedorn does indeed write the majority opinion in Wisconsin's redistricting case.
He's joined by the court's three liberal justices, and this four-justice majority picks the governor's maps. In this game of least changes, Evers has won.
The opinion Hagedorn authors is straightforward. He says the governor's map moves the fewest number of people into new districts, and it's, quote, not a close call.
Hagedorn says the other parties to the case don't offer any other measures of least change that are better than the governor's. He says the governor's assembly map is, quote, vastly superior.
So that's the majority opinion. And at this moment in early March, that opinion is effectively the law of the land in Wisconsin.
The court's other conservative justices disagree. And Justice Patience Rogenczyk says it's her hope that the United States Supreme Court will be asked to review the case.
And they do. They review it. More on that after the break.
We're listening to the latest episode of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. We'll hear more from Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening to the newest episode of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out, getting us caught up on the redistricting process in Wisconsin. We just heard about the state Supreme Court decision approving electoral maps drawn by Governor Evers, a decision that was quickly reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, at this point in time, nobody really knows what the U.S. Supreme Court is going to do, because the court doesn't have to do anything. They could just ignore this plea from Wisconsin Republicans like they do with so many other appeals.
But for this case, the U.S. Supreme Court is paying attention. And about 3 weeks after Hagedorn chose the governor's maps, the court steps in and reverses the decision. Evers' victory is short-lived.
Why did the court take such a dramatic step? Because of the Federal Voting Rights Act, the VRA.
Look, we're going to level with you. We find the Voting Rights Act, as it pertains to redistricting, to be complicated. And that's an understatement.
What makes it complicated? Decades of case law, which is not always clearly defined. A lot of math. And what one party says is good for minority voters, another party might say is straight up racist.
When you read Voting Rights Act redistricting decisions, it's easy to get lost in some of the minutiae. You're supposed to start with a three-part test. You consider the totality of the circumstances. VRA cases live and die by this stuff.
And it's not just semantics. There's a reason this law exists in the first place. Marquette University law professor Atiba Ellis is an expert on the VRA.
I think to understand that story, we first have to understand the kind of nature of the racial apartheid that the VRA was designed to fix. And in a way, this takes us all the way back to Reconstruction.
In Ellis's view, a lot of today's political challenges stem from this period in history after the U.S. Civil War. Freed slaves were given rights, but they were incomplete, and new laws were passed that took Black people's rights away.
The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed as a response to this, an effort to right the country's wrongs.
So the idea is that the Voting Rights Act allows for minority citizens to fully enjoy participation in the political process.
When it comes to redistricting, the VRA can be used to protect those rights in a couple ways. It can be used as a justification for drawing maps a certain way. Mapmakers can draw more majority-minority districts to ensure minority voters get to elect who they want.
The VRA can also be used after maps are drawn to try to overturn them. If minority voters think they've been packed or cracked by a redistricting plan, they can sue. And courts can and do redraw maps based on these claims.
But whether you're being proactive or reactive, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you have to be careful about when you use the VRA. If you give race too much weight, the court has said, you might violate the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of equal protection, the 14th Amendment.
This is where the U.S. Supreme Court says the Wisconsin Supreme Court got it wrong. The governor's map, the one Brian Hagedorn picked, created an additional majority-minority district in Milwaukee.
Hagedorn said he thought there were good reasons to believe that the district was needed, but his opinion didn't say much about why. Ellis says that was the weakness of Hagedorn's ruling.
What the U.S. Supreme Court basically argued was, look, you didn't walk through these factors in sufficient detail for us to determine whether there was a violation.
In a 7-2 unsigned opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court sent the case back to Wisconsin. Ellis says the court essentially ruled that Hagedorn needed to show his work.
Now, at this point in late March, there's still a chance the governor's plan could prevail. So Evers' lawyers get to work. They tell the Wisconsin Supreme Court they could resubmit their map and show their work this time.
Or they could submit a similar map and only adjust the Milwaukee districts.
The legislature disputes this. They tell the court that the governor shouldn't get another chance.
They say the only answer to this problem is a map that is race neutral, one that doesn't consider race at all.
And who has been saying that their map is race neutral since the beginning? The legislature.
In fact, at the public hearing on the legislature's map, only two people testified in favor: Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Republican Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue. And they both stressed a key point about how the maps were drawn.
These employees were instructed not to consider race when drafting the legislative maps.
In hindsight, Voss and Lemahue chose their words very carefully that day. They were laying the groundwork for when this inevitably went to court.
But Marquette Law's Atiba Ellis sees a troubling trend.
The Voting Rights Act, in and of itself, is about being race conscious.
For Ellis, the worst case scenario is that courts put so much emphasis on race neutrality that the Voting Rights Act itself is declared unconstitutional and its protections for minority voters go away.
But in the short term, the race-neutral argument persuades the Wisconsin Supreme Court. On April 15th, the day candidates for the legislature are scheduled to begin circulating nominating petitions to run in the new districts, the court issues a final decision.
Four justices pick the legislature's map. Brian Hagedorn is one of them. Hagedorn does not write the majority opinion in this ruling, but he does write a short 4-page concurrence. He says he didn't think the court's earlier order choosing the governor's maps was based on a Voting Rights Act argument. But once the U.S. Supreme Court said what it said, and with time running out, Hagedorn says the legislature's map was, quote, the remaining option.
University of Wisconsin-Madison law professor and redistricting expert Rob Yablon disputes that.
Even at that late stage, I do think it's an exaggeration to say that there weren't any other options that were available.
Yablon says the Wisconsin Supreme Court could have taken more evidence. They could have reconfigured the Milwaukee districts. They could have drawn a whole new map. These are things courts do, Yablon says.
But instead, the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted the legislature's map wholesale, without changes. The same map that the governor vetoed and the court itself rejected the first time.
After the opinion came out, Yablon analyzed how the final Wisconsin map compared to other court-drawn maps across the country over the past 20 years. He compared them based on several metrics that measure partisanship. He says the maps endorsed by the Wisconsin Supreme Court are in a league of their own.
These maps really stand out as being maps that look exactly like a very strong partisan gerrymander, the kind that you would expect from a legislature which was trying to tilt the playing field in its favor. And of course, that's what this legislature was trying to do. They were trying to reinforce and perpetuate the gerrymander that they had adopted a decade ago. And ultimately, they got the Wisconsin Supreme Court to sign off on that.
But it's not just a carbon copy of the old map. Lines did move. Districts changed. We're not going to walk you through all of the changes, but we can give you one big picture outcome. There's basically no competition under this map.
And to be sure, there wasn't much competition under the old map either. But in some places, despite the best efforts of mapmakers, competition started to bloom. The population changed. People moved. Attitudes changed. And seats that were drawn to be safe became competitive. They were suddenly up for grabs.
This new map shut that down. And it's super apparent in one part of the Milwaukee suburbs.
What we are looking at right here is my district runs down 65th Street right here. And then behind us on Clark.
state, Representative Robin Vining's Assembly District includes parts of Milwaukee and Waukesha counties. Historically, Waukesha has been hugely important to Wisconsin Republicans, the base of their power.
Vining's district used to be a part of that. For example, in 2014, Democrats didn't even field a candidate here. It was considered safely GOP.
But over the past decade, Milwaukee's suburbs have been changing. Vining, a Democrat, noticed this.
So back in 2018, we had started to notice a crack in the gerrymander.
Vining saw a growing block of Democratic voters in the district, particularly in her home of Wauwatosa. She thought if she could mobilize those voters, she could win the whole district.
And we looked at the math, and we saw that it was in striking distance. We saw it was possible.
And she was able to do something that no other Democrat had done before her under the 2011 map. Robin Vining flipped a district from red to blue, winning by just 138 votes.
Initially, it seemed like Republican leaders viewed Vining's win as a fluke, not indicative of any pattern. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss told Republicans at the state GOP convention in 2019 that Vining's win would be short-lived.
We lost one seat last time to a woman who's going to be a one-termer. I'm not even going to tell you her name because she's going to lose.
It turns out this win wasn't a fluke. In 2020, Vining won by 8 percentage points. Given what people had assumed about the district, it felt like a landslide.
How did Republicans address Robin Vining's district in the 2021 map? They gave it to her.
Under the new map, the Republican legislature's map, Vining's district becomes a safely Democratic seat. President Joe Biden would have won it by 23 percentage points.
How can conceding a seat to a Democrat be a good thing for Republicans? The districts next to Vining's answer that question.
Like the one held by Democrat Sarah Rodriguez. She ran for the legislature in 2020 against a Republican incumbent.
And it was drawn to be a Republican district at the time. But as the 10 years have gone on, the district had changed. And I was able to...
Like Vining, Rodriguez seemingly beat the odds. She flipped the district, winning by just 735 votes. But unlike Vining, Republicans conceded nothing to Rodriguez in the new map.
Where she used to have parts of Milwaukee County, her new district is almost exclusively Waukesha County. By the numbers, it would be tougher for a Democrat to win here.
And by doing all of that, they also protected a Republican Senate seat that was trending Democratic.
Now that the legislature's map is final, what will elections look like?
Out of 99 assembly districts, only 3 are projected to be within 2 percentage points. Only 3. The rest have basically been decided before a single vote is cast.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden.
And Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg. Edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand. And digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
Coming up after the news, a number of analysts are worried about the future of democracy in the United States, especially after the attempt to overturn the 2020 election outcome. Our guest looks at the emerging threats, what's driving them, and where we can find some signs of hope. Remember, you can follow conversations like these all the time over at WPR.org live stream or check out the archives or install the Wisconsin Public Radio app on your smartphone. I'm Rob Verrett. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.